Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Blood in the Streets of Syria and the Surrounding Region, A Future of Crisis, presented by Mr. Thomas A. Dine, Search for Common Ground. This is the third lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. Thomas Dine, involved in U.S. foreign policy for more than 49 years, is currently the Senior Director of Track 2 Project Between Americans and Syrians. For nearly 3.5 years, this diplomatic effort has taken place in Syria and the U.S. among 16 prominent individuals from each society under auspices of Search for Common Ground, a Washington-based NGO that deals with conflict resolution situations around the world. Prior to this pursuit, Mr. Dine served as CEO of the San Francisco-based Jewish Community Federation 2005-2007, president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague, Czech Republic 1997-2005, USAID Assistant Administrator of Europe and Eurasia 1993-1997, Executive Director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee 1980-1993, Professional Staff in the U.S. Senate 1970-1980, Personal Assistant to the American Ambassador, New Delhi, India 1967-1969, and U.S. Peace Corps Volunteer in the Philippines 1962-1964. This lecture took place Tuesday, 13 December 2011, Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the third Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University Lecture Series for the academic year 2011-2012. Title of this series is Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. If you were here last month when we hosted Dr. David Hathaway speaking on Saudi Arabia, he said that most of the current upheavals in MENA, Middle East, North Africa region are not revolutions, which he described as not being a single event, i.e. the overthrow of an unpopular leader, but rather a process that involves, and I quote Dr. Hathaway, major shifts in the economic, political, and social sectors. In the case of Syria, our topic today, if the current efforts to remove Bashar al-Assad's regime may in fact come true, I think it will usher a revolution. A revolution which will impact way beyond the borders of Syria as it stands. Here to discuss Syria, a country close to my heart, I've never been there, but I actually have family members. Most of you do not know that, but my great-grandmother is from the city of Aleppo. Again, never been there. Close to my heart, but somebody who actually, a speaker who's close to my heart, Dr. Tom Dine, Mr. Tom Dine. Tom is currently the senior director of a Track 2 project, that's informal diplomacy, under the auspices of Search for Common Ground involving prominent individuals from Syria and the United States. Tom has worked in U.S. foreign policy issues for more than half a decade, jobs that include, you can read all of them.
Half a century.
Sorry, half a century. 50 years, not 5 years. My apologies. See, as my boss, he still corrects me. Which included the job of the USAID Assistant Administrator for Europe and Eurasia. And for 13 years, Tom was the Executive Director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And most importantly for me, he was President of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, at my birthplace of Prague, where I had the honor of being one of his 600-plus employees. That's where I met him. And when he left RFERL, there was no more reason to be there, so I left and I was, Dr. Wilson became my boss. Before I introduce it, I leave the floor for Tom. I just want to let you know about the next lecture, which will be actually next year. The next lecture will be on 12th January 2012. It will feature Dr. Soner Çıkaktay, Director of Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. We have selected Turkey because neither Turkey is experiencing the upheavals, nor, of course, is an Arab country. However, for two reasons. One, we all think that Turkey has perhaps the most influence in what is happening in that region of the world. And secondly, students specifically from Commander Staff College requested, and we're thankful for that. We always like requests, we like ideas, and they said we'd like to hear about Turkey. So I think we have somebody that in the region and maybe even beyond Washington is one of the foremost experts on Turkey. If you have not heard him or read his work, we encourage you to come here. If you're not registered, please see Adam Seitz on the side there. And it will be 12th January 2012, right here, same time. Is it? Tom, thank you very much for accepting the invitation.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'd like to extend my thanks first to the Marine Corps University Technical Studies Department for asking me to speak today on the topic of the Syrian uprising. The quality of this lecture series, which I did notices on in Washington, I think is unparalleled, and I'm happy to be a part of it. And my personal thanks to you, again. You want to adjust the technology here?
Yes, please.
It's echoing. As Amin indicated, we met about a dozen years ago when he and I worked together at Radio Free Europe and Liberty, where Amin was a constitutional and political analyst of Western Asia, in particular Afghanistan. I remember well his purpose and passion about Afghanistan, and that Afghanistan accept a just and practical constitution, and he had a hand in its making. Because of our common dedication to developing the right kind of substance, I've always enjoyed and respected his, your intellectual enthusiasm and our friendship. And I also appreciate the fact that you are a U.S. Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Which is my segue to a related topic that I want to tell this audience about. It's close to my heart. My son-in-law, Timothy Stefani, is a lieutenant colonel in the active Marine Corps. He deployed just a week ago on his birthday in his current assignment as the XO of the headquarters battalion of the 6th Marine Regiment in Helsinki. His wife, my daughter, Amy, is here in the audience. And that, of course, shows me up. So Godspeed to him, to you and your boys, and all those in the armed forces and families that serve our country. My comment today is certainly timely. The Arab uprising that began in Tunisia 13 months ago arrived in Syria last March, when Syrian security forces, in the flame of discontent, lit that flame so it could burn high and throughout the land. They used live bullets on their own citizens, and in this case, three young boys in the modest Sunni tribal area of Deraa, which is located just 3 miles from the Jordanian border. Since then, internal violence and cruelty has become the country's theme in 2011. And analyzing the violence and cruelty tells you where the country is headed, and that is my theme today. Syrian society is deeply, indeed, dangerously divided for and against the ruling family, among religious and tribal sects within Syria and among its bordering neighbors. Violence and chaos increase on a steady, sometimes daily basis. The United Nations today, for instance, adjusted its killing list, claiming that 5,000 Syrians so far have been killed since the protests got underway in March. Now, someone I have not introduced, but this is another segue, if you will. With us today is Dr. Samir Al-Taki. He's a heart doctor from Syria, born in Aleppo, and he's a dear friend of mine, and he and I worked together on a track to diplomatic effort. And when I told him that I just heard that the UN Human Rights Commission had just said 5,000, he said, it's 15,000. And that has enormous ramifications, obviously. I've been involved in conflict resolution situations for much of my career, moderating Muslims and Christians in the Mindanao province of the Philippines, between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, in Bangladesh's break from Pakistan in 1971, the use of foreign aid to help stop genocide in Bosnia, the flow of accurate timely reporting during the two Russian wars against its vassal state, Chechnya, and of course, the Israel-Palestine conflict. The latest is a non-governmental interchange in efforts at improving U.S.-Syrian relations, building bridges between prominent Americans and Syrians for the past 3.5 years. In this process, I have been in Syria 9 times, often received by Dr. Al-Faki, the last time 3 days after the Friday killings began on a national basis in the third week of March. I had arranged for Syrian interlocutors coming to Washington, to Houston, to Los Angeles, and to introduce them to the United States. My stories show that Track 2 reconciliation is not an easy exercise. At best, it only works for a short period until governments decide to relinquish resentments, recognize each other's vulnerabilities, swallow national pride, and agree to pursue a common agenda. In Track 2 diplomacy, one must listen, and listen, and listen some more. Recognize each other's common humanity, and build personal trust so that pragmatism takes over the process. In listening and encouraging and engaging in open, frank, and equal dialogue among all the individuals at the table, and also, as I did in Sevier on several occasions, walk in the narrow back alleys of Damascus, one learns a great deal. For me, it was about Syrian fears and perspectives, as well as the narrow-mindedness and limitations of a repressive regime. That is why I am horrified at the cold-bloodedness of Bashar al-Assad's rule, but I'm not surprised. In this regard, I, like many, was hopeful that the son would be different than the father, that Bashar was a reformer determined to bring economic and technological modernity to his country, and would encourage a new cooperation between the government and the governed, indeed, political pluralism. But alas, the apple does not fall far from the tree. It's the same brutal, violent tactics as the father, and that's the reality of today in Syria. The five most commonly asked questions that I get, whether it's a seminar in Washington, or a dinner party, or individual conversation, I'm asked about the current crisis inside Syria. And these five questions are, when will Bashar and his family depart from power? Second, isn't Syria already in a civil war? Third, because of sectarian tensions, will bloodshed continue in the streets of Syria even if the regime falls? Concomitantly, can reconciliation be achieved after the widespread use of torture, the volume of blood of children and innocent civilians that has spilled over the streets around the country, and of course, flagrant violations of human rights? Fourth, can democratic values and governance, with a multi-party system, the rule of law, and the protection of individuals replace many years of repressive rule? Finally, what will Syria and the regime look like in 2013? So, for further view, your call for a revolution. Give it a little more time. Obviously, regarding question number one, when will the Assads give up, has been asked since February, when Mubarak fell from grace, and in the third week of March, when the shootings of civilians commenced in southern Syria. Since my March visit, I have tracked 6 indicators that take these 5 questions into account. offer you some insight into a Berkeley UT blood-filled environment. So my first indicator that I've always tried to study is crowd size. According to the size of the crowds in Tahrir Square in Cairo, also in Tunisia, Libya, and Yemen, and their effect on regime changes, estimating the size of mass demonstrations is critically important, and you can use it as a predictor. The Syrian crowds have been extraordinarily large in certain places, and it would be a way to judge, if not predict, Assad's unpopularity in his final exit, dead or alive. But in Damascus and Aleppo, Aleppo being the largest city, Damascus the second largest, Damascus the capital, precedents have been almost, protests have been almost nil, apart from those at universities. The merchants of these municipalities have accumulated wealth from the regime's policies, which has made individuals less likely to go to the street. Additionally, there are large numbers of security forces present in these crowded cities to prevent any mass gatherings from the moment any sign of protest begins. Most of the protests, most of the killings, have taken place in homes. It has a mixed Christian, Alawite, Sunni, and Shiite population. It's the heartland of both peaceful protests as well as the spiraling sectarian violence. Another killing field has been, and again somewhat repeated now, Hama, both of these places in central Syria. Hama has a large Sunni majority and has then experienced the heavy hands of Hafez, the father's brutality 29 years ago when it predicted 10 to 20,000 were killed. The sun is not looked upon favorably in Hama as is the father. In the port city of Latakia and other medium-sized towns, there have been consistent stirrings and protests. These are often organized in response to events in other parts of the country, as these peaceful protesters are eager to show solidarity with their fellow Syrians across the country against regime violence. The crowds practicing nonviolence for the most part have daily shown the bravery and determination of great numbers of urban youth. There is a large and growing opposition to Bashar's rule, and the regime has consistently denied many parts of Syrian society equal political footing. On the ground, however, a united opposition has been elusive. It is fragmented. Yes, there are local citizens' committees. There are traditional secular oppositional figures. The Muslim Brotherhood exists, which is organized, and groups and individuals in the diaspora. But these groups lack coordination and are without direction, moving forward at a snail's pace after a half century in which they were suppressed, largely inactive, and lacking legitimacy. While a serious threat to the regime exists now, the crowds have not been of overwhelming size or of the kind that made it clear to the Egyptian military to tell the world that it was time to go, time to fold, hand in the cards, leave the state. The Assad family will not be finished until large and sustainable uprisings occur in the centers of Damascus and Aleppo, and an opposition is united sufficiently and can lead in seizing the day and the country's future. The second indicator is the military. It's based on the Egyptian model, that is the role, particularly the loyalty of Syria's military. But let's keep in mind that each situation across the Maghreb and the Arab Peninsula and up and down the Gulf's littoral is different. In Egypt, the military had enough political clout to call the shots and force the guard out of office. In Syria, the army, while of good size and importance in society, does not have comparable power. Further, the army is held in check. Indeed, has been undermined in Bashar's time by special security services, that the family and their closest ally loyalists control. The threat of military mutiny has been and will seemingly stay minimal. Real power among those with weapons held by the Republican Guard wing of the Army, manned mainly by allies, and commanded by Maher al-Assad Bashar al-Jabbar's right. By security, special security forces that are headed by a cousin. And then there are the death squads, or what I also call militias. Those in army uniforms that have fled, forming the Free Syrian Army in late July and stationed inside Turkey, have been lower rank officers and non-officers. The defenders are a relatively small number, although reports are trickling in of armed groups on the rise in Syria and coming out of protected areas in Turkey. And one question, the normal number is that there are 10,000 in the Syrian, in the Free Syrian Army, but nobody knows for sure. With the surprising tough anti-Bashar line being taken by the Arab League for the president to stop killing civilians, it is assumed that this is a signal to the armed forces to defect and turn the crisis into an armed struggle. In this regard, the regime's two biggest nightmares are a Benghazi scenario that will come to pass, either a breakaway army to establish a foothold along the Turkish-Iraqi border region, or mass killings that start in Aleppo and then spread. In addition to being Syria was a populous city, Aleppo, in my view, has the greatest potential for becoming Syria's Benghazi. But overall, the real power of the regime lies with security forces, not the army. And most are keeping to their barracks unless ordered to put down a protest in the streets. Third indicator is the ruling opposition. It's the strength of Bashar's political coalition. That is, the strength of his political coalition is comprised of Ba'ath Party leaders, Sunni elites that run the Damascus and Aleppo business communities, leaders of minorities, diverse as they are, Alawites, Druze, Christians, Kurds, Ismailis. They feed from the regime's trough of oppression and economic favoritism, and they fear sectarian strife under the conservative Sunni rule. So far, the coalition's loom is holding. Fourth indicator is the economy. The degree and depth of the economy's deterioration is critical. The economy has been crippled by months of political unrest. As a variety of media reports indicate, as well as ongoing World Bank analyses and anecdotal sources, Syria's economy is no longer standing still but slipping downward. More and more are living hand to mouth. A 5-year drought was already playing havoc in the important agricultural sector. Now there are riots of political chaos in the rural regions. Short and long term US and EU sanctions are squeezing banks and exports and foreign investments. Foreign money transfers have been stopped. Oil and gas production by foreign companies have come to a halt due to the embargo. The purchases of the open market of arms is an international no-no. There is now a ban on travel of all designated individuals, including Bashar himself. Commercial air travel in and out of the country is constricted. The biggest hard currency earner, tourism, has dropped to almost nil. Hyperinflation looms large. One of Syria's former allies and trading partner, Turkey, has halted economic cooperation, such as trucking and imposed cruising sanctions. Funds and technical services, however, are coming in from the Iranians. The Syrian pound is now backed by the Russian ruble. Iraqis have assured an economic cross-border fluidity that so far keeps the Syrian ship from sinking. It is a fact that the longer the protests go on, the weaker the economy becomes, a matter that concerns the leading businessmen, to me that is an opening that hopefully can take advantage of. Fifth is information control. internal social media, that is emails, textings, and still shots, videos recorded on cell phones and small cameras that are then uploaded to YouTube, is a factor against the state control of the media. There's a pair of satellite stations like Altura, American back station, Al-Arabiya from Saudi Arabia, and Al Jazeera, and other alternatives, that is TV and radio, are coming out of Lebanon and Turkey. All these to counter tightly controlled state-run print and electronic information centers. The regime has faced the street protesters with violence and an information blackout that includes threatening, even bribing, the clergy and other religious leaders, so that the religious message coming from all sects in the regime's message about armed gangs and international interference is consistent and helps in that control. The official media is weak. It lacks credibility, lacks any star figure to convince and calm the public, but it has not yet been superseded by all the modern means at our disposal. Finally, my sixth indicator of regime instability is the activities of the one who Vogue magazine heralded the Rose of the Desert. This is Asma Assad. Where is she, the wife of Bashar? Where is she? Is she sticking with an at-all-cost policy? Her father remains in London and has desperately tried to distance his family from the Assad regime, according to press reports. No one has so far discovered any evidence of a secret purchase of a faraway villa along Mexico's Pacific coast. For instance, there's that article this week in the Washington Post about Gaddafi's son looking for a villa to fit the family, or in southern France, or in and around Yalta. There is no evidence of visits to Swiss banks to withdraw a family fortune so far. I project that Asma Assad faces a big dilemma. What to do? What to do about the children if they're going to have a future? What to go with? Where to go with the international criminal court system now with global reach? And with the Syrian opposition hounding you, is there anywhere to hide? Particularly from the furious families of those killed in the streets, and those tortured. They will be free to hunt down Bashar and family anywhere in the world. It's not like the good old days when we emptied Haiti and the others of the dictators. So where is the Syrian uprising at this point? Can the regime hold on to the political status quo by administering on a daily basis huge doses of violence and torture, stopping a spring from happening? Can oppositional forces stick to nonviolence in the streets, or will violence, real violence, beget violence? Of my almost 5 decades of involvement in public policy, I have never seen a government behave so badly and take all the wrong steps in trying to prevent and then handle a crisis as had Bashar Assad and his small group of loyal advisors. Even before the bloodshed of March 17th, Bashar Assad's 11-year tenure has been marked by promises of reform that were never kept. Now the regime is engulfed in state-sponsored bloodshed and tragic undertakings, including massive human rights violations, policy mistakes, ineffective talking points that the disorder and bloodshed stem from foreign plots, armed thugs, religious terrorists such as domestic militants, Muslim Brothers, Saudi-funded Saudis, and those sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, basking over official responsibility for the violence by the army and special forces and militias. The ultimate in political theater came last week in Barbara Walters' interview of Assad, when he defiantly denied under ordering or being responsible for the national crackdown, saying, quote, "We don't kill our people. No government in the world kills its people unless it's led by a crazy person," end quote. Assad, knowing he and his regime cannot last without killing, has become the agent of instability and destruction in Syria and the region. Bashar is a trained ophthalmologist. He had an 18-month internship in London. In his school days in Damascus, it is reported that he was a mild-mannered chap that did not seek power. So what happened? How is it he has acted like that crazy person he mentioned in the interview? In Bashar's first 5 years in office, he allowed corruption by the oligarchy few, such as Rami Mahmoud, to become dominant. Mahmoud is purportedly the richest man in Syria. He learned that the government is the family business. And then Michael Corleone, he reluctantly got sucked into the wrong role. To stay in power, is he calling the shots now? Is his family? Is it the Alawite inner circle of chiefs? What we do know is that the Assad era is, I believe, over. Humpty Dumpty may still be in his heavily guarded administrative forces, high above crowded Damascus, thinking delusional thoughts. But his reputation cannot be put back together again, and the political future for Syria is violence and chaos, and he is already being held responsible. In Syria, a weak but hopeful spring is now facing the gloom of winter. The crisis is at a point of no return, left with only three scenarios, and I rely on my friend Samir al-Taki for these three scenarios. The regime, first is the regime using the security solution, including more and more open ad hoc shootings and the work of the death squads, in which these shootings help to beat back the unarmed and armed oppositional forces, and they prevail. The regime, however, would find itself staying on a constant state of alert for the rest of its existence, a la North Korea. Iran and Hezbollah would be winners. The only foreign intervention I can foresee is Turkey spreading its territory into that part of Syria, which can allow the Free Syrian Army, hopefully growing, to have a safe haven from which to make incursions and fight. Scenario two is that public discontent on all sides to the conflict leads to a ceasefire and a peaceful transfer emerges. This means Turkey and the Arab League guarantee that the regime accepts and agrees to a multi-party democratic transformation over a specified timeline. Third, the country goes into a full-fledged civil war that could last through 2012. This is the bloodiest scenario. As I said earlier, the longer the current course goes on, more assured that this will become the scenario. A coordinated combination of Turkey, the Arab League, the EU, and the US would then be faced with the inevitable task of finding ways to achieve a truce and conflict mediation talks and change the regime. As has been true in all the Arab revolts this year, the Syrian uprising is the people's doing. A response to decades of injustice and indignities forced upon the people by their corrupt and cruel leaders. These unknowns in the street and the squares of cities and towns have arisen to offset traditional fears and weaknesses and inactions. Can weakness become strength? Just last week, a Syrian journalist, a friend of mine, used the words of a legendary Syrian poet to describe this desire for change from passivity to activism. I paraphrase what my friend wrote. We stand tall like telephone poles, staring blankly into the skies like idiots. Technological and public policy changes pass above the heads of the telephone poles. Tectonic plates move beneath us, yet we feel nothing. We know nothing. We remember nothing. We keep asking God to stay with us. And I would add my words to that. However, change and freedom must come. if we were to have a positive future, that revolution, not even that you want, does take place. Thank you.
If you have a question, please raise your hand, introduce yourself, and ask a question, but I will raise my own hand and ask the first question, if I may. Tom, you mentioned Iran in passing a couple of times and sustaining them on economic and with technology, and also right now you said if the situation continues that Iran and Hezbollah will be the winner. But do you have any more specific information of what Iran is doing? Because when you read Iran in media, they actually show thousands demonstrating in support of Bashar al-Assad, and the way they cut and paste these, it's just amazing that you know that they have cut and paste these pictures and heads and all flags. What is Iran doing to prevent what is maybe one of its most important, if not the most important ally it has in the Arab world or anywhere for that matter? Thank you.
I think the Iranians, I do not have any specific information.
You?
Care of the group.
Yes.
Go ahead.
According to our knowledge through the coordination committee.
Excuse me, I should say Dr. Al-Taki was kicked out of Syria for being a good guy, for being too close to Americans and Westerners and wanting to change, Bashar changed the regime, and they saw him as just a mouthpiece of us. He's living now in Dubai and running a think tank there. Sorry.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored. I think Iran helped the regime in many ways. Technically, they are very much helping the regime in terms of controlling the internet, controlling both means of communication. So this is really drastic, and they have a center in Damascus, near Susa, they have an Iranian center which is supervising and responsible for the communication with Hezbollah, with Iran, and also for the control of the internet. So this is the technical side. We have another side, which is now beginning to happen, where there are a shortage in human resources for the regime, and we have pretty accurate information that there are hundreds of people coming from the Shia, Iraq, and from Hezbollah, especially snipers, and they are being given the Syrian identity, and we have even long lists of names, etc. So there are some technical supports. They are advising the regime. Also, they have been behind the advice regarding the snipers using, killing the elites of the demonstrations, targeting personally those persons, as they used in Iran in the last uprising. And now the new information is that there are beginning of a heavy infiltration of the Iranian military in relation to the Syrian military everywhere. So it's really reminding many of Syrian military about what had happened during the cooperation of the Soviet Union. So they are everywhere, in every place, in every entertainment of the visions of the Syrian.
Thank you.
The floor is open. Yes, please.
Tom Dell, I was wondering on your three scenarios, where do you see the possibility of the other Alawite families or clans throwing the Assads to the wolves in order to maintain the relationship with the Sunni elite and maintain power? And if you see that as being feasible?
Well, we know that there are discussions with various Alawite people. There's no group, particularly in a diverse society like Syria, that is homogeneous. And certainly the Alawites are not. They enjoy being connected to the Assad regime, Assad's regime that started in 1970. I'm aware of some discussions by political oppositional people with Alawites but I have yet to see anything come above the surface. And as I've indicated, I think that glue is sticking very well in holding that whole political coalition together. It's, you know, the British are not the only ones who invented divide and conquer, divide and rule. All of us know that instinctively. And that would be the way, if I could control a chessboard, that's the way I would do it. Go ahead, break up the merchants in Aleppo and in Damascus, break up the Alawite support, and start peeling people apart. And pretty soon, you can conquer. But as yet, that has not occurred. And it's very tough to do, obviously. Because there's going to be reprisal. My guess is that the goon squads will use live bullets on most people as well, even though they may be customers. So we haven't seen the evidence that coalition is breaking up. That's not true.
Yes, please.
Paul from Zebra, Marine Corps University. I'm just wondering, if you do end up with the third scenario, the Civil War, how do you think the sectarian lines are going to break down? Is it going to be on religious lines? Is it going to be in terms of ethnic lines? How do you think what do you think would be the composition of? I mean, obviously people don't go, I'm X and I stand in side A or side B, but where do you think the tendencies will go? Will it be a rural-urban split?
Well, as I indicated, the rural people are really
right.
But as you were asking your question, I was thinking to myself, what did the people of Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri think in 1861? Which way did they go? Some went south, some went north, and some stood and sat on the fence. My guess is that's what happened there. It depends on who feels that they're losers now, and who will be losers later, I think. Because self-interest is going to control not only the Allies, but the Kurds. The great fear of Turkey is that the Kurds, that Bashar Assad will continue to feed the Kurds, who will then help in the activities that are taking place in eastern Turkey right now. It drives everyone crazy. The Christians, my knowledge, they're really afraid. And their numbers have diminished slowly but surely. So, I don't want to be. I believe there is a civil war now. It isn't massive yet. But I don't see. I tried to be a little more graphic, but Humpty Dumpty is not going to get back together. And it's only a question of when. And now we've been saying that since March. Oh my God, shooting people in the street, they're shooting their own. But it hasn't happened yet. And here we are, almost the end of December. So, 10 months, another 10 months, another 10 weeks. Nobody knows. For those of you in the intelligence community, I've yet to meet somebody in our intelligence community who knows. At least we believe that on them today.
Yes, sir, please.
I'll give you another question. Out of the Sunnis, and let's say the Sunni and the Leaf that are connected, please, Doctor, if you want to get into this. Do the Sunnis in the cities possibly fear the Brotherhood in Hama, or the Brotherhood in the more rural areas, and some fundamentalism? And the reason I ask that question is you said the fear of the Christians. And what is exactly the Christians are afraid of? Are they afraid of the Alawites? Are they afraid of the
Brotherhood? I think everybody's afraid of Sunni rule. Mm-hmm. And a intolerance of minorities. Hafez al-Assad was a brilliant political tactician in that sense. He drew the minorities to him and gave them protection from the majority. So, and that's what Bashar is trying to do now, is scare them. that, oh my God, what's coming, not only Sunnis, but the most religious and militant, i.e. the Muslim Brotherhood. But I don't think brothers have shown their hand that way yet. And they recognize that they better be moderate, as they're trying to do in Tunis, Cairo. Let's see about this. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, no.
Please.
The Muslim Brotherhood doesn't exist as a big organization within Syria. It is big outside of Syria. We have about 1,500 leaders or activists immigrated out of Syria after the meeting. So within Syria, they are not organized. But the way they work is very complicated. And I don't know if we have a kind of a central mosque and a number of satellite mosques that spread the ideology. And from that, there is a system for recruitment which is completely split from the preaching system. But it is not necessarily the Muslim Brotherhood. It is rather the popular Islam all over. And it is, if we follow the line of the Zakat distribution, it is going along those lines rather than the lines of organization of the Muslim world. Zakah, which is the Islamic tax payment. And it is a special system of social support and solidarity. We have popular Islam. Many, many of them do not like to be identified as Muslim Brotherhood, even they hate to be identified as Muslim Brotherhood. So they are not linked de facto with the Muslim Brotherhood. But gradually, with the money coming from the Muslim Brotherhood, paying the coordination committees in support, gradually they are becoming more and more linked to the Muslim Brotherhood and Turkey. Turkey is playing a major role in supplying the money and really linking the Islamic bases with the expatriate leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is very important. But still, there is no complete coordination between those two factors, inside and outside. The more the war will proceed, the more the sectarian division will go on, the more we will have more radical alignments toward not only Muslim Brotherhood, but maybe Salafist and radical Islam. So, I think this is the situation.
I have to pause here. Isn't it interesting? No one has asked yet. What should U.S. policy be?
That's my question.
If
there's a civil war ongoing, what should be the U.S. policy?
Well, I'll tell you what I didn't mention. I mentioned the U.S. in the context of the EU. Could do. I don't think the United States has leverage in Syria to play a leading role. And if there is going to be an international force of some kind, a la Libya, you know, Obama administration was accused of being playing a backseat role. What's going to be in the trunk on this one? And because I think we would do the opposition harm, because we, the United States, unfortunately, would be used by the Palace Guard as the indicator of, you see, the imperialists are here, and they're trying to bring us back, and they're colonialism, and so forth. I don't think we have a role to play front and center. I didn't say we don't have a role to play, because whether it's a multinational force, whether it's the NATO, EU, Turkey, I don't think the Arab League would offer arms in any kind of rule six. But the United States would have to be a part of it, but we cannot be out front. I think that was a lesson learned well in Libya, and I think we would have to do it again, if not really stay behind there.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking so much as forces as policy. What are the policy
You know, I reviewed that before coming here today. Since the spring, Obama had a late comment about what was taking place. And he finally said, it's time to step down. And then over the summer, there were periods of quiet. And then Mrs. Clinton says something. They said something, but never in front of the EU. And finally, that Turkey has gotten out of its quiet. And as Erdogan and the foreign minister gotten so angry because they feel like they've been slapped in the face over their policy of be nice, but be tough. Now they can't, they don't even want to be nice. So the statements, Mrs. Clinton said something like, well, she got the opposition in Geneva a week ago. And so those are all good signs, but it doesn't really change anything on the ground. And the fact that our ambassador, Robert Ford, is back, I've spent a lot of time in my career on the Middle East. I've never seen such a brave, what we used to call the old days, Arabs. He is out there. He was out there. They chased him out of the country. He's come back. I don't know if he'll be meeting with oppositional leaders so visibly as he did before. But these are gestures that count in diplomacy. We all know that. I think that's what we've got to offer. Gestures toward Assad. You're either going to go with your toes up or walk out. But you've got to go. I think we have to keep reinforcing that. I think we have to keep preaching nonviolence. I think we have to use covert action with deterrence, cross-border business, and also the Lebanese. And eventually help push this crisis to its some kind of conclusion. Although I think after Assad and his family go, there will still be crisis because of this, the sectarian tensions and fears that they'll then go at each other. That's what the Civil War has got a long way to go.
I put the notes all the way in the back.
I think I'm sitting in the back because I can project forward that way. I've been in Syria about four times the last couple of years. My perspective is probably a little different from yours because the type of people I'm talking to are not government officials. You've drawn a very clear picture of the nasty government in relationship to the democratically inclined folks. Probably agree with that. There's no way other than to interpret that profile. Yet near the end of your comments, you said if that situation is reversed, that government is no longer in power, there will be repression of minority religious groups, the Nestorians, the Chaldeans, the Catholics, Orthodox, Adventists, etc. in that group. Is there any way to prevent that? The second question I have comes from the questions that were asked of me at the time. Many of the people I talked to said that Assad himself, Bashar himself, was a person of liberal views, forward-looking, but that the second level of command that he had to deal with, the people who were left over from his father's regime, were repressive to the point that they, that the fulcrum that they had had a balance under their father was in danger because it had become too oppressive. The folks I talked to said they would like to support Bashar, but not that second level. Is there any way that that is part of the realm of the possible?
Thank you.
I am one of those who initially wanted Bashar Assad to be a reformer. It sounded good, it was rational. He had spent time in London. He had married this beautiful, sophisticated, Western-oriented woman featured in Vogue and every place else. And just looked and sounded right. And now, I know this is not off the record, but I still, look, I hang around Capitol Hill. And Senator John Kerry took that upon himself. He accepted that perspective. He took his wife, Theresa, and went to Damascus twice to dine with the Assads. You know, I just picture the silverware and the wine glasses, etc. It was a good Western and well-served deal. But he bought it and came back and gave a speech at the Brookings Institution. I forget the date now, but it was April, May, doesn't matter. And praised and said, just wait and see, we're going to have a good outcome here. Well, he won't say a thing now. He's been burned. The Boston Globe has beaten him down, and he's been criticized by Harlem Intelligentsia and his own party members. Hey, why did you commit yourself to such a hopeful sign and post? It's because we won. We look for outcomes and we try to figure out how to get there. So I fell for it until I got to know people like Dr. and his friends, associates, connected to the regime. But they had not lost their critical facilities. And I think that's very, very important. So, Bashar, Damascus, it was 4 days before the speech he was supposed to give on how to respond to the protests. And his chief spokesperson, who's then Shaban, who's a very sophisticated person, she got a PhD from Leeds University in medieval English literature. And she's quite good with language. She was on television giving a press conference in her Manhattan black dress. She looked great. And she said, reform is coming, just you wait and see for the speech. And it reminded me of the good old days. You're too young, but I lived through the LBJ administration. And every time LBJ gave a speech before Congress, there were the two, Johns Hopkins University is a famous one, it was always, how much butter and how many guns for Vietnam and our own fiscal situation. And he always gave you both. So I said, is this guy going to pull an LBJ? Gives the speech, and it is one of the roughest, toughest state talks I've ever heard. I wasn't there, but I watched it over the internet. And it's really been downhill ever since. So I don't think he is a reformer, obviously. The second level, no one seems to know for sure who's in charge. We think we know the family, the most intimate, the brother, the younger brother, the sister, the brother-in-law, the ones he made very rich by crony corruption tactics early on after he became president. Those people have something to lose, therefore they're not going to give anything up unless you put a bullet through their head. I'm sorry, I cannot remember what you said about religious groups. You listed all the Christian.
If there's a regime change, things are turned upside down, what will happen to the religious minorities?
Oh, wait, I didn't use the term the people in the street are Democrats, small people Democrats. I don't know what they are. And if you've never practiced democracy as we do in our country, as we grow up with values and policies and processes, procedures, my God, drive you crazy. All the checks and balances, I don't have to tell the group of people in government. But it is a form of democracy. I don't think they know democracy. But they're going to have to learn give and take, that's for sure. I think that there's regime change. And now this is my wishful thinking. You know, people like his profile come to office. The other side would say come to power. Come to office and try to change the whole Syrian mindset. Then you'll see a word I said before, the intolerance of the Syrians, it's the fear. Well, it's the tolerance of the new Syria that I would certainly hope for and enjoy. But that's a long time coming. I don't think I think people who are most closely associated with the current regime will pay a cost. The rest of the people will figure out a way to survive and get along. Then I think also of the South Africa situation where you have a reconciliation process put together, which helped to heal that country. I lived 9 years in the Czech Republic, and they never went after the communists. And even my person I glorify and a good friend of, Václav Havel, he never wanted to open up the files. He never wanted to start making trouble. And I don't think that cleanses the power, if you will. And I think the Israelis are going to have to do that. But there are ways of preventing further agony, further pain. And I suppose each country will, society will figure that out. I don't think all the Syrians are going to be in much trouble. It's the Alawites that will be in trouble.
Any last questions? Yes, please.
Do you think there's a connection between the violence in Syria and the Sunni tribes in western Iraq? And if so, do you think there's a possibility that it could spill over back into Iraq?
Well, we know about the Sunni tribes in western Iraq because not only of our own armed forces, but that's always been a bill of particular between in the bilateral relationship, the official U.S.-Syria relationship. And even when we non-officials got together, that was our issue number one. Close your damn borders. Close that international airport. And understand that these folks are bringing in ammunition, weapon systems, whatever, to kill us. So that's our first priority, is to get you to behave like a good man. And give a take of that. About, I don't know the official figure now, but it's about 1 million to 1.5 million Iraqis came across the border to live safely in Damascus and other places. They were mainly Sunnis. They always said that they couldn't go back because the Shia had taken over their neighborhoods and their homes. So now what you're indicating in the question is going to be the Syrian turn across the border to seek safety. It could happen, but so far we haven't really seen that. And I had to think about it. Yes.
May I just add something to you, please? What happened in the last 2 years is that the Sunnis in Iraq, and especially the Baathists that are living in the majority in Damascus, had felt that they had been betrayed by Bashar al-Assad first. Because he accepted, and Maliki, he accepted the game of the Iranians in Iraq, etc. And that's why I think now they are seeing their own tribes, their own people being killed in Deir ez-Zor, Mayadin, and Daraa, which is also an extension of their tribes. And those people have made now a new coalition in Iraq to support their parents there in Syria. And they look not toward returning back and fighting the Americans, no. I think they are seeing now the Kurds and the Americans, potential allies, against the Shia's Iranian and Lebanon coalition. And this is a major change that we have to feel. I'm feeling it because we are in contact direct with them. We are organizing this kind of support between those tribes and the internal. And if there is any potential for a safe haven now in Syria, on the border, that would be possibly near Rabia area, which is on the border between Syria, Iraq, and especially near Kurdistan and partially in the area of Al-Anbar and the Jubur tribes. So one of the potentials, I don't see any potential of spilling back to Iraq, not over. I think now there is a kind of reconciliation, kind of a of correction of the pattern, because there is this feeling that Bashar al-Assad had betrayed.
Please.
Do you have
a question? No, I thought. Sir?
Can I have a...
Yes, please.
It's not really a last word, but for whatever my words were worth, you've got a second speaker here to go, and I will thank you, Samir, for being here, number one. Number two, I tried to launch your presidential career here. I don't think it will work, but let me know that at Marine Corps University, the road to the White House
will be the only one.
As they say in the Bible, from my house to your ears.